From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Capitol Notes, coming to you from our KQED studios across the street from the state capitol. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and as always, rubbing his face, pondering the week's events right now. He was rubbing his face. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly. You always hate that I just come up with every little thing you're doing.
Well, you said, as always, rubbing his face. I'm always rubbing my face.
I put two things together. As always, Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly. And joining us this week, Kevin Yamamura, reporter for the Sacramento Bee and their Capitol Bureau. Kevin, thanks for sitting in.
Thanks for having me. Rubbing my face.
He's not rubbing his face. Our pro bono political correspondent, Kate Fulmar, we believe is happily honeymooning, do we not?
Honeymooning, anyway.
Where is she?
Don't know. Do you know where she is?
Turkey?
Thought she was going to Spain. Well, we'll find out when she comes back. Kate, if you're listening, which we know you're not.
That's pathetic if you're listening.
Yeah, right. Drop us an email. So obviously, here we are for this week ending August 10th to talk about the big political news of the week, or some of the big political news of the week. Well, let's start the same darn place we have started for, gosh, I don't know, the last month or so, which I guess would be the ongoing budget saga. Now, before we completely begin to talk about what happened, I did notice that there was at least one interest group person who used my terminology from last week this week. Did you see that, Anthony?
Which terminology?
Gang of 14.
Oh, no, there's been several who picked that up.
But it started on this podcast last Friday.
Wow.
Gang of 14. I take credit
for it. It's been modified a little bit, too.
What's it now being called?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems like
in polite circles.
Well, in polite circles. I don't know. Somebody seemed to call it the Gang of 14 white privileged men.
Oh. I heard that. I think that was tacked on to it, unfortunately. I did not, however, say that. No. All right, so let's talk about what happened this week. Anthony, why don't you give us your 2 cents on at least the events.
Well, in terms of the progress of the state budget, nothing happened.
Yeah.
And if anything, it's devolved into sort of there were some personal attacks being exchanged by Democratic leaders and members of the Senate Republican caucus. Both Speaker Fabian Nunez and Senator Don Parada called press conferences this week basically to say that they were not interested in renegotiating the deal that they thought they've already agreed to, digging in themselves. And the Republicans have continued to hold their ground and say, you know, with the exception of Abel Maldonado, the moderate Republican from Santa Maria who's facing reelection next year, the other 14 are holding firm and not going to vote for this budget.
Well, let's break it down a moment because, I mean, Speaker Nunez's event, I think, probably was for lack of a better term, was the one to watch at the beginning because he'd been out of town. You know, the assembly has been on recess for 3 weeks, July 20th. And Republicans in the Senate have been clamoring for the assembly to come back and deal with the budget because they want the assembly to come back and approve modifications. And Speaker Nunez said, they're not coming back in session. I mean, he pretty much put the nail in the coffin, did he not?
It seems to be that way. I mean, Speaker Nunez has made it pretty clear since he left that he wasn't going to have him back. So holding true to that.
And then looking at Senator Parada's statement that no way, no how on modifications to CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that actually ends the clamoring or not, but they were fairly definitive statements, both of them, it would seem like.
Well, are we in agreement now that it's CEQA? That's what the budget standoff is about? I mean, this has been a moving target for us. We've tried to figure out what this is about every week. This week, it seems to be primarily about CEQA.
Which is kind of where we started.
Right.
It was one of the early arguments as to why the Senate Republicans wouldn't approve the budget.
Right. You know, Senator Parada's press conference this week was focused, as he said, on CEQA. And the speaker had sort of tried to reapply pressure, counterpunch a little bit, saying, hey, look, if this is still open on August 20th, there are all these things that Democrats didn't want to vote for in the July 20th version of the assembly budget that are going to be back on the table. And so if you're going to push for more concessions from us, we have a whole new list of demands, and I don't know where that leaves us in terms of trying to get a deal.
But. And the list of demands included kind of traditional Democratic things, did they not?
Yeah, I mean, there were
less cuts in social services,
right? The COLA for welfare recipients, all sorts of things, cuts to public transportation, things that the Democrats say they didn't want to vote for. That in this July 20th version of the budget, that still apparently isn't good enough for the Senate Republicans.
And where is Governor Schwarzenegger in all of this? He's on vacation.
He's vacationing. Nothing public planned.
and sort of staying quiet and behind, working behind the scenes, and his office his last week sort of got involved in a slight brouhaha with trying to go after Senate Republicans through a grassroots press release campaign.
Talk about that helped. for people who didn't catch that one. Talk about what happened. It was a little embarrassing for the governor's office.
From what I understand, in talking to some of these Republican committee members, state Republican committee members, they said that there had been an email sent out asking whether any of them would like to help out the governor's cause in getting the budget passed by expressing their views on the budget, particularly suggesting that Senate Republicans ought to not be as obstructionists as they might be. And in this case, one of the several activists who sent out emails last week after the Senate failed to pass a budget had included a blow-by-blow from one of the governor's staffers in which the governor's staffer had advised this activist on how to write this press release. And so it was
almost verbatim.
It was very clear that the governor's office was helping to orchestrate a reaction to Senate Republicans not voting for the budget. And this is the kind of thing that the governor's office has been trying to do, and trying to be involved and push the debate in one direction, but not to be so obvious doing it.
Although they have been pretty upfront in other ways. I mean, the governor's communications director, Adam Mendelsohn, has a blog that's probably with a readership about as large as our listenership.
Oh, come on. We've got to have one more listener than he has readers.
Well,
and where's the blog? On what site?
It's on the governor's actual website. I don't have the URL
handy. gov.ca.gov.
Well, that URL, right. But I think you can find it through there. I don't have the direct link to the blog. My apologies, Adam. but point being that on that blog, I think Mendelsohn was pretty open in calling for in laying the blame at the feet of Senate Republicans. In this morning's Modesto Bee, Mike Genest, the finance director of the governor's Department of Finance, calls out Jeff Denham in response to an editorial that Jeff Denham wrote explaining why he isn't voting for this budget.
Jeff
Republican
Denham.
Senator from Mercedish. Area.
Mercedish.
Yeah.
Yes. We actually got an email back from someone who, after last week when we said that there wasn't a lot to do in Merced, and sent us all these.
I said the governor would be resentful of having to go to Merced in August. It was nothing about Merced. It was a commentary on the weather and nothing else.
So. A nice clarification from our Merced native who emailed us back. But
yes.
But yes, that editorial that Genest wrote, was a response clearly to a state senator who's been really the target of trying to get that second vote in the Senate.
But I think the larger point is that it illustrates that the governor's office really is focusing on Senate Republicans. They believe that Senate Republicans are responsible for holding this budget up, and they're siding with Democrats, as they have since basically July 20th on this budget fight.
Well, let's talk about the reality of the budget fight for a moment. I mean, we're sitting here on August 10th, which is a Friday. If the Assembly truly doesn't come back until they're supposed to come back, they come back, on the 20th?
Mm-hmm.
And then the legislative session is over for the year. Second week of September, which now you really do have serious questions about the rest of the agenda at the Capitol this year. I mean, you really are running out of time.
Well, and yesterday, Senator Perotta said they're not going to do anything else besides the budget. So
there are a lot of issues on the table.
And the governor's office has essentially said the same.
Let's think about the biggest one, health care. You wouldn't argue that's the biggest or not?
No, I would, but I would not discount the possibility that the governor could call a special session after the September 14th recess to focus on healthcare. I started hearing stuff about that this week, and I think that that's probable, or at least possible, depending on how long this budget stalemate goes and what happens at the end of it.
But let me ask you this. Doesn't that, in a way, take the pressure off a little bit of Republicans in the state Senate then? If they know that a huge issue that they could get blamed for derailing, like health care, is not going to come, doesn't have to come up until, you know, after mid-September, then could they just not dig in their heels a little bit more? I mean, I hate to be playing devil's advocate, but, you know, unfortunately, that's the way everything seems to work, and the calculations about this budget at this point is what outside forces and what outside actions positively or negatively affect the chances of a deal. And so, I mean, someone could clearly argue, oh, great, well, we don't have to worry about ticking off anybody about health care now.
Well, if we're going under this assumption that the Republicans don't want a deal on health care,
right.
They don't want any, which, you know, I'm not saying that that's true, but going off that assumption, you know, I think if there's any leverage the governor has, it could be, again, vacation, saying, hey, look, you know, this budget's going to drag out, but you guys aren't going anywhere on September 14th. Go take the Jewish holidays off, and then we're coming back, and we're going to talk about health care through the end of the year. That might be an incentive to try to get this budget done quicker. I don't know.
That could be good leverage. I mean, if you do go under an assumption that Senate Republicans don't necessarily care that the health care deal gets done this year, then, you know, perhaps that provides an incentive to stick this out as long as possible and delay until September. But if you're talking about other forms of leverage, that's an interesting option, a special session, and you could see it come into play.
Yeah. And what, I mean, you know, just kind of to, I mean, because there really wasn't a whole lot of actual change over this week in the budget debate. There was a lot of yelling and screaming. There was a lot of posturing, quite frankly, about what you would or wouldn't do, but there weren't actual substantive negotiations to sit here and report on. But, you know, one of the things we've talked about here on the podcast before, and Kevin, I'm just curious for your take on this, too. What does this do about the, you know, where does the governor fit into this now? And what part of the governor's reputation might be riding on this and his national post-partisan reputation? I'm just curious. You spend a fair amount of time following the governor for the Bee.
Well, some people have suggested to me in the last couple of weeks, I mean, that this is where his post-partisan message is feels most hollow, perhaps when you get into a situation, right, where a governor is looked to be a leader, and that being a leader, being a post-partisan, you know, leader who doesn't like confrontation, who wants to bring people together but isn't willing to recognize that there are substantial philosophical differences that have to be dealt with and confronted head-on, perhaps, that you might have to burn some political capital to make a deal happen. You know, this might be where his post-partisan message starts to get thin, and that he's going to have to burn some political capital to get something to happen. And people will eventually. I mean, this could look. Everybody wants to make this look bad for Senate Republicans, but voters out there, you know, tend to. From what I understand, voters out there tend to put the blame on everybody, on the governor, on Democrats, on Republicans.
But does he have the political capital to burn in Republican circles? I guess that's really the question. I mean, and I'm not sure that any of us know really the answer.
No,
but
I don't know that he has it in Republican circles, and that may be one reason why he's helpless in some ways in that regard.
Yeah.
Well, and also you've got 14 Republicans in the Senate who over whom you have no leverage. I mean, these are 14 incredibly safe seats. The only person who's in a marginal seat next year, Abel Maldonado, has already cast a vote in favor of the budget. There's nothing you can do to these Senate Republicans you don't have any leverage. And I think that that's going to be a part of, look, if Senate Republicans are clamoring for redistricting reform, they're making a pretty darn good case for it by prolonging this budget standoff. And I think that the governor will seize on that as he tries, probably futilely, but does try to get some sort of redistricting reform on the February ballot alongside the term limits initiative.
Well, it's the the long, ugly summer continues on this. I think we're done probably predicting when this thing is going to be solved, aren't we?
I am. Yeah. I am.
we earlier on earlier podcast, for those of you who might not have listened, we felt very confident that we had somewhat predicted correctly with the start of vacation, at least for the assembly. But, oh, boy, we ran into the buzzsaw of the Senate, and I think all predictions are off at this point. I mean, I really do. I've told lots of people I won't be surprised that this one sets the record, if it sets the record, beyond Labor Day, because they are so intractable, and, you know, and the gear up to getting something before Labor Day would be really hard.
What is interesting, though, unlike that standoff, there was something, I can't remember who wrote it this week, but you know, the amount of blame that Gray Davis got in that standoff that went into September compared to the amount of blame that Governor Schwarzenegger's getting for this standoff.
Very different.
Yeah, very different. I think it just speaks volumes about the way the public reacts to Gray Davis versus the way they react to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, given that that controversy didn't seem to be going too far this week, let's switch to a different controversy that did kind of heat up this week, which was about the machines that Californians can use to vote on in February. Secretary of State Deborah Bowen coming down with some decisions about voting machines, in particular, some pretty tough cracking down on electronic touchscreen machines. Kevin, you drew the tremendously short straw of having to be one of the reporters who was there until all hours of the night last Friday. I fortunately was out of town and didn't have to draw that one. But let's talk about what Bowen did.
Well, she was, besides creating a very long night for those of us in the Capitol Press Corps who drew the short straw last week, she issued a decision on electronic voting machines in California that will take effect next February during the presidential primary. That decision will essentially curtail the use of electronic voting machines by voters who are not disabled in a couple dozen counties here in California, counties such as Riverside, which had been using electronic voting machines for all of their voters now. Now, at the very most, we'll be able to put one electronic voting machine in each polling place, provided that they meet certain new security requirements that Bowen had set forth. And so the registrars are up in arms about this. For the most part, California would be going to a mostly paper ballot system. And the secretary pointed out that she thought we were going that direction anyway, with the rise in absentee voting and many counties still do use paper. So
some of those counties, I mean, you know, watching and following the story, some of those counties, you really do have to wonder what the impact's going to be. You mentioned Riverside, which is a great example, which has been all electronic touchscreen machines. San Diego County has been all electronic touchscreen machines. There's still a bit of a problem in Los Angeles County that's not touchscreen machines, but again, you're talking about where one of every four California votes comes from, with their system is somewhat in limbo at this point. You've got a lot of unease on the part of local elections officials. And you do have to wonder at a certain point, I think, what signals voters take from all of this and the comfort level voters are going to have when they go to the polls in February, especially some of these counties, as we were talking about, they haven't voted on a different system in years.
That's true. And I think there is a valid point here that voters have a right to wonder what kind of confidence they should have. And, you know, we've had three different secretaries in a very short period of time, for different reasons. But because of that, there have been these changing in the sort of evolution of standards and what's acceptable and what's not in California with electronic voting machines. And so, you know, voters might be confused as to, you know, what they should have confidence in and what they shouldn't.
And all of this clearly based on testing that Bowen authorized recently by a group of UC researchers who largely show that these machines can be hacked into, vote tallies can be changed, of course. The criticism from local registrars was that there were no security protocols used by these teams, so these teams effectively just had open access to the machines. But I'm wondering, we all watched what happened with Kevin Shelley when he went, not what happened to him in the end, what happened to him when he went after electronic touchscreen machines. And he got some praise, he got some criticism. But he was a bit of an activist as a Secretary of State against these machines. Deborah Bowen is starting to look somewhat like a similar activist against these machines.
I don't think that's any surprise. I mean, if you followed Bowen's legislative career, or her campaign. I mean, it was she was very critical of. I think she even had a YouTube video, basically that she
showing
put together.
Someone hacking into a machine.
Yeah, that. So I don't think the fact that she's coming out skeptical, let's say, against these machines is any surprise to anybody.
And I think, you know, now the big shoe we all think could drop could be lawsuits filed against her action to block her action.
Wasn't there one filed earlier this week? One of the counties, I thought yesterday.
Making rumblings that they might, I think, was how
I just read headlines, not stories.
Come on, you know,
just more than most these days.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
You're actually a very detailed reader then sometimes. But, I mean, no, they're clearly rumblings. But, I mean, I would say, Kevin, would you agree that's kind of the shoe we're all waiting for to drop to see who might file lawsuits, and if they do, who would it be? Would it be
certainly
counties? Would it be
vendors?
The manufacturers? Would it be disabled voters, perhaps?
Yeah, possibly.
Because one of the interesting arguments out of this, I thought, was that there were some saying you're leaving these electronic machines in place to be used for disabled voters, you know, and primarily because you have to because of federal law. But you're leaving them in place for them. But then you're saying that those machines aren't safe, and that's why you're taking them out for the rest of the voters.
Yeah,
and
does that sound not like equal protection?
Yeah, or, does that not somehow sound like you're somewhat undercutting that? Now, Secretary Bowen says that's not the case, but you would wonder, again, there's another avenue of people who could be unhappy.
Sure. Again, that gets into the issue also of perception and voters' confidence in what they're using. And, you know, she had to make that decision, I believe, because there are federal requirements to provide new updated machines for disabled voters. And, you know, many in the disabled community have been large proponents of the electronic voting machines, touchscreen machines, because they do give them an option to vote without requiring help from another individual. So they give them privacy and independence. But I think that was a concession that she made to she felt to either meet federal law or provide those machines to those voters.
And would it be safe to say from your coverage as well this week that, I mean, this is just yet another chapter in the ongoing battles, it seems like, between local elections officials in the state and
certainly
the chief elections officer, who's the Secretary of State?
Certainly. And that battle was no greater than, I think, during Kevin Shelley's time when...
But Bowen's going to be in the press a lot, so, you know, her media team should get up and running and, you know, like, really be prepared to, you know, in the coming months here to be dealing with the press.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting few months, to say the least. Well, let's topic three for this week would be some late week developments that, Anthony, I think you watched on what looks to be a really brewing battle, potential brewing battle, I guess. Boy, what a qualifier there. Brewing battle, potential brewing battle.
Oh, it's brewing.
I'm trying to be too safe. The battle between different gaming tribes in the state, but a whole host of other organizations and interest groups, largely over these gaming agreements, these compacts for the four tribes in Southern California.
Right. Four of the largest gaming tribes in California received new deals, basically, that would allow them to, in some cases, more than double the number of slot machines they have. And now there have been four separate referenda filed to repeal these compacts. Looks like they're headed for the February ballot. Initially, the opposition to the compacts came from racing tracks, horse tracks, and organized labor. And they were sort of wheeled out as the front people on these referenda as well. But this week we saw who the real power is behind this. We saw $1 million move in from two rival Indian tribes, the Pala Band and the Auburn tribe. And it looks like there's going to, if this does go forward, now they dumped $1 million into a signature gathering effort to qualify these referenda for the ballot. It'll probably take four times that to qualify them for February.
But let's just say, I mean, the racing tracks have already put in, word is, around $4 million to that effort, and organized labor's put in some money. I mean, in other words, there's right. already a fair pot of money out there to gather these signatures.
Yeah, and these groups, I mean, racetracks have ponied up before, so to speak, for Prop 68 or Prop 70. I don't remember which one was which, but when there were back in, was it 2002?
2004. Oh, how time flies.
It's all blurring together. And organized labor as well it looks like money's coming. So, you know, I think right now there was a question of whether or not these referenda were real or whether it was a bargaining position from the racetracks or or other groups trying to get their own deals. But I think now you have to proceed on the assumption that
they're real,
that they are real, and that we're going to be voting on these in February.
And I mean, and the way this is shaping up to be, I mean, really shaping up to be a huge political battle. I mean, a slugfest. I mean, 20 million per initiative is a number that's been thrown out there easily. And you're four of them. So you got $80 million potentially on the table of campaign money for a yes or a no vote on these four gaming compacts. I mean, that's...
Excuse me. I got to go be a political consultant. I'll be right back.
Your second career is calling.
The profitable one.
And let's, you know, just briefly for those who didn't follow everything that happened on these, the reason organized labor jumped onto these is they didn't like the provisions dealing with how casino workers can organize. Is that a
right.
fair characterization?
Yeah. Yes.
And yes, everyone says. And so now you've got one group of tribes on one side, another group of tribes on another side. Is there the potential for other tribes, we think, to join in on this overturn the compacts campaign?
I think so. And I think if you're looking for clues as to which tribes those may be, there are tribes that are affiliated with a group called the California Tribal Business Alliance. These are tribes who, many of whom have renegotiated their own deals with the governor over the last couple of years that have placed limits on slots. Now, CTBA, as an organization, they maintain that they're remaining that they're going to remain neutral through this, although Paula and Auburn are both members of CTBA. But other tribes like Viejas, I don't know if Viejas is going to take a position on these compacts, but Viejas is a member of CTBA. And I think that there could be more tribal involvement before this is over.
And again, since I don't think we did this, the four tribes in question, the compacts in question, are Agua Caliente, Morongo, Sequan, and Pechanga.
Yes.
Four fairly powerful gaming tribes in Southern California, all which would stand to really increase their profits by expanding their slot machines under these deals and going to go all the way to the ballot now. And I'm just wondering, I mean, do any of you guys think the governor gets involved in this at all? I mean, does the governor just stay the heck away and hope that he doesn't have to be drawn into it? Or what do you think? I mean, Kevin, thought on – because the governor
got involved last time, right? I mean
– what's that?
He did get involved last time in 2004.
But in this particular
time,
these are his babies.
These are his deals. I mean, he's – you know, whether it's passively or actively, he's got to come out against the referendums. I don't know.
We will get something Friend, tells me we will
get,
have
get me a style book.
Something quick. Tells me we'll have that solved by come.
I think AP is referendums. I don't know what my Latin teacher would say.
Someone will clue us into that. I'm sure someone listening to this.
Right.
Well, we'll have to see where it goes. It'll be an interesting few weeks to watch that
and
one.
What an election that'll be in February. You've got term limits and the presidential primary and.
Yeah,
all on your paper ballot.
Yeah,
so, hey.
Well, yeah. Let's talk about what's shaping up to be on that paper ballot. Exactly. Term limits, four referendas, a community college measure.
Referendas, huh? I don't think that was.
I just threw that out there. A measure about protecting financing for community colleges,
right.
Which, boy, that won't get a whole lot of attention, unfortunately, at this point, though the consultants for that now will email me and say they should be getting it. And then, yes, a presidential primary. Oh, by the way, presidential primary.
That.
It's going to be one... long campaign season.
Yeah, and I do know it should be noted on the term limits thing, you know, both Paula and Auburn have contributed money in favor of the term limits initiative.
To modify term limits, yeah.
And I think that leadership is concerned about these four referendums being on the ballot in February because there's some concern that it might take away from the funding. If all the tribes are spending on these four initiatives that it's going to take away a potential source of funding for the term limits initiative. So take that for what it's worth.
I feel like a lot of what we've talked about this morning is are subjects that we're just waiting for something else to happen on. You know, you're just waiting, you know.
Oh, it's summer. It's summer.
It is, I know. But it's like the anticipation of the next chapter of all those political fights.
Yeah, and it's going to be, I think, a busy fall and winter. Very, very busy.
No time off for any of us.
Not at all.
No recess.
No recess for the Capitol Press Corps. Well, I guess that'll do it for this edition of our Capitol Notes podcast. For Anthony York from Capitol Weekly and Kevin Yamamura from Sacramento Bee. Kevin, thanks for sitting in.
Thanks for having me.
You had a shorter Friday today, I hope, than last Friday with the voting machines.
Well, that remains to be seen.
It's early.
Right. It's still early.
It is still early.
I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio and the California Report. We'll see you next time.